Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On Tuesday, the Associated Press sent out 5 breaking news alerts about Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's address to the U.S. Congress. The address, which looked like a State of the Union speech and was boycotted by almost 60 Democrats, received 23 standing ovations and widespread coverage in the media. Most of the coverage focused on the deepening tensions between Netanyahu and President Obama. Even though the speech focused on Iran's nuclear weapons, very few Iranians were quoted in the major papers, and very few outlets pointed out that Netanyahu made the same dire predictions in a 1996 address to Congress. In Israel and among Israelis, Netanyahu was widely criticized for giving the speech just 2 weeks before the Israeli election. Writing in Rolling Stone magazine, Matt Taibbi writes, Yigal Kaspi, Israel's ambassador to Switzerland, retweeted a line from an Israeli journalist, quote, "Is it no longer possible to suffice in scaring us here in Hebrew? Netanyahu has to fly all the way to the U.S. Congress and tell them in English how dangerous Iran's nuclear program is," end quote. Taibbi reports that Kaspi and 2 other diplomats got the axe for their social media response to the speech. Well, joining us to talk about coverage of this, and it got a lot of coverage this week, is Eli Clifton, a reporting fellow with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute. He focuses on money and politics and U.S. foreign policy. Hi, Eli. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Nice to have you. And Chris McGreal is a senior writer for The Guardian. He's former Washington correspondent and was previously posted in Johannesburg and Jerusalem. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. And Golnar Motivali is a correspondent for Bloomberg News based in Tehran. Hi, Golnar. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Morning.
Morning. So as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So Eli Clifton with The Nation, what did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, on a completely different note than the speech, which I think we'll be talking about quite a bit, the article that really caught my eye this week was Travels with My Censor, an article by Peter Hessler with The New Yorker. He's been based in Cairo most recently, but some of his best-known work came from China, where he wrote 3 books and reported for The New Yorker. And this is his sort of his profile of his censor when he returned to China to do a book tour for one of his books, for the Chinese translation of it. I thought it was a fascinating look at censorship in China and trying to sort of peel back some of the layers of it, go beyond the typical revulsion and knee-jerk response that we typically have towards it, and instead looking at the individuals who are responsible for it, and ultimately how it reflects a changing sentiment from Chinese leadership in terms of what type of language and what type of news reporting is considered acceptable.
That's interesting. So in a nutshell, what did you learn about the censors?
I mean, in a nutshell, you learn that the censors don't always, they also are nearly as confused and uncertain as the writers are about what will be considered acceptable in any given moment to publish. And it changes on a year-by-year, if not a month-by-month basis. The censors are fairly open about that they also are trying to feel their way through essentially a pitch-black room to determine what it is that will be acceptable to publish right now versus what it was acceptable a year ago. And sometimes they get it wrong. And obviously that has a consequence for them as well as for the authors whose work is often being translated from English.
So sounds great. Well, thanks for that one. That's Eli Clifton. He's a reporting fellow with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute. And Chris McGreal is a senior writer for The Guardian. Chris, what did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, as luck would have it, I was going to mention exactly the same piece.
Oh, wow.
I did think it was fantastic.
I don't think that's ever happened before. That's great.
Yes. It was a very striking piece. It was the one that instantly sprang to mind. And I haven't really had that much chance to read much else this week. It's been incredibly busy. But I think the thing I loved about it was it's, you know, so much is written about China that doesn't really get under the skin. And this is a piece that just gave it insight into aspects of changing China. You know, by a man who's lived there, who's written about it in such depth for so long. Was offered a feel for the place, a very human feel for the place. And I thought it was fascinating piece.
Oh, that's great. Well, thank you for that. Maybe we'll invite Peter to join one of our Friday shows in the near future. And what about you, Golnar Motivelli, correspondent with Bloomberg? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
A piece in the Financial Times about the rebels in Syria by Erica Solomon. I thought it was very interesting because, you know, I'm looking at, like many other journalists, a completely different part of the story from Iran. And for a long time, it's been a question mark for me what the situation and the status of the rebels are at the moment in Syria. And I thought it was a really very interesting timing as well. It was published, I think, on Monday or Tuesday, and it was very well done. I mean, the interviews were mainly done out of Turkish border cities like Sunni Urfa and Reyhanli, but I think it just gave a very kind of quite a comprehensive feel at how the rebels and the opposition to the Assad government are struggling at the moment, how they're quite disparate, and how they're finding it extremely difficult to kind of gain any momentum at the moment, given the kind of advance that ISIS has made.
Mm. Well, thank you for that one. You just reminded me there was a great piece in The Guardian this week about a group called the White Helmets. And these are people just providing basic humanitarian aid in Syria. And a number of women have now joined, which is a very big deal. And they raised a lot of money on Kickstarter to actually buy vans from Turkey. And they're just going out on the streets and helping people. So that's another really amazing piece. So thank you for that, Golnar. And we will provide links to these stories at yourcallradio.org. And speaking from your vantage point in Iran, Golnar, you were in Tehran when Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu gave his speech to Congress. How widely was his speech aired? A lot of Iranians have access to satellite dishes.
Yeah, so on the domestic TV channels that are state-run, it wasn't obviously broadcast anywhere, and I don't think that was surprising to anyone at all. Press TV, which is also run by the Iranian government, but is an English-language news channel, they did run the speech, although they were analysing it in the studio with a panel of guests at the same time, so it wasn't like a simultaneous live translation or live broadcast of the speech. But as you said, you know, about 70% of Tehraners have satellite dishes, and many of them, from the ones that I spoke to, did tune in. They watched it on other satellite channels like BBC Persian that translated the speech live into Persian simultaneously. So they did watch, and they were interested.
What did you hear?
Well, afterwards, I spoke to a couple of people before the speech, and they were aware that Netanyahu was preparing to make this speech before Congress. One person I spoke to, a fabric seller downtown Tehran, he said that, you know, he's just another politician, and all politicians come out with the same thing. They're just full of self-interest, and we ordinary people are just in the middle, struggling with sanctions, struggling with our livelihoods. After the speech, I phoned a few people, and what struck me was how upset some people were about the tone. They found the content quite, you know, upsetting, that a statesman would go to such an important assembly and say things that they felt were really harsh. And I think what worried the people I spoke to afterwards was this sense that this individual has so much leverage with the United States, with a country that their own country is negotiating with over the nuclear program. But at the same time, they were very aware of the context of the speech as well, the context in terms of Israeli politics and the elections there, and also the context in terms of what Netanyahu was trying to achieve in Washington, which I think they felt, one person I spoke to in particular, she said that I found that quite reassuring to know that this wasn't, this was very much about a political game that Netanyahu was playing for people watching back home and also in Washington.
That is Gulnar Motivali. She's a correspondent for Bloomberg News based in Tehran. And if you'd like to, if you have any questions for Golan, we noticed that hardly any Iranians were quoted in most of the major newspapers. I mean, here's a 40-minute speech about Iran, and very few Iranians were actually quoted. And so if you have any questions for Gulnar or any thoughts about the coverage you saw, we'd love to hear from you at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Chris, did that strike you at all? I mean, that's what I saw in the U.S. I don't know if the European media quoted any Iranians, but you would think that a speech about Iran would get some reaction from Iranians.
Well, certainly in The Guardian, and I think in other British newspapers, I saw a couple of other papers, had articles from Iran about the reaction to the speech. So it was definitely there. It was perhaps a little slower in coming, given the speed with which everything goes up on the internet these days. I think it took, I think there was an article up after about 4 or 5 hours in The Guardian. It took a bit longer than the reaction here, obviously. But it was there, for sure.
Okay, well, that's good. Eli, did you see it in the U.S.? Because I didn't see many Iranians quoted.
Hardly any. I would just say that the way that Netanyahu characterized Iran in the speech was one that was so close to a fictional portrayal that it may have even been of limited utility to get Iranians to respond to it when your country is being compared to clutching Israel with three tentacles of terror, engaged in a deadly game of thrones, and having a voracious appetite for aggression. The characterizations there were such that clearly the goal was not to reach out to an Iranian audience, and it was to portray a country and a people that that certainly even most people who don't hear from Iranians might have some questions about the accuracy of those characterizations.
Well, we've got a few calls on this, so let's hear from Michael in San Francisco. Hi, Michael.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I kind of followed a lot of the coverage of it leading up to the speech, and I kind of find even your address of the speech today off the point. Iran is a threat in the Middle East, and in the whole world, and everybody opposes the acquisition of nuclear weapons by Iran. And Netanyahu has given this speech before. I think it was actually Feinstein and Pelosi who said they would not be attending the speech. They've heard this message before. I mean, his fear is legitimate. What I find illegitimate, though, is that it's all more Israel bashing. The real focus, I think, ought to be on Boehner and the Republican Party for the invitation in the first place. One can understand, you can disagree, and I do disagree with Netanyahu on a whole host of issues and wish he had not come to speak to Congress. However, I think the real story is that Boehner and the Republican Party broke protocol in inviting him here to begin with, broke protocol in the middle of nuclear discussions between the United States and the international community with Iran right before an election in Israel. I only heard one passing reporter question Boehner about poking his finger in President Obama's eye by inviting him here. And I think that's the story. Nobody is really holding Boehner and the Republican Party their feet to the fire for causing this. There's no reason to bring this man to speak on this topic. He's given this speech for years, as I'm sure your panelists will discuss. But I think the press really failed. It's cheap and easy to do Israel bashing on this. The real target is to hold Boehner and the Republicans feet to the fire. Could you imagine back in the first Gulf, or the second Gulf War under second Bush, when France was condemning the United States' actions, if the Democrats had invited the Prime Minister of France to come when they were changing the name of French fries in Congress to Freedom Fries? I mean, the different treatment between the two presidents by the two parties, that, I think, is the big story.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in. So, Gulnar, what are your thoughts on this? Michael says what he said was really not the issue. We really should talk about the protocol involved in this. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I can't really, as a journalist at Bloomberg, I'm not really allowed to give my opinions, but I would say that I think from the point of view of Iranians who are living under an extremely difficult set of economic kind of tight economic factors at the moment, for them, it's a real tangible, you know, the sanctions have a real and have had a very tangible knock-on effect for their lives and their livelihoods, many of them, particularly the middle classes and the working classes. These groups have felt a huge amount of economic pressure on their lives in the past 2 or 3 years. So if they have any sense or feeling that these nuclear talks may be derailed or may be under some kind of external pressure, whether it's from Saudi Arabia or whether it's from Israel or any other country that they may perceive pressuring the negotiations, then it becomes a real source of worry and concern for them. Having said that, I think the reaction both with the government and generally among ordinary Iranians to the speech was by and large kind of, this is ridiculous. Like, the idea that, you know, it sounded to them in the beginning, I think there were parts of that speech that were very offensive. One person I spoke to, an analyst, a very well respected former advisor to the reformist president Mohammad Khatami, said to me that this is desperation. This is really, really desperate, and we can see this, that it's desperate. And in some ways, that's better for us, because it shows that Iran and the United States are somehow getting closer to an agreement, because Netanyahu is feeling some kind of pressure from this. So, I think from the Iranian point of view, there's a real, you know, it can work both ways. There's a real concern about the amount of pressure this could put on the talks and the knock-on effect that could have on getting a deal by July, and at the same time they're very aware of how the rhetoric was being interpreted by critics of Netanyahu as well.
And that is Golnar Motavalli. She's a correspondent for Bloomberg News based in Tehran. Chris McGreal is a senior writer for The Guardian U.S. And Eli Clifton is a reporting fellow with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute. Eli, what are your thoughts? A few outlets have mentioned that what Netanyahu said on Tuesday, he said back in 1996. How do you think journalists should put this narrative in perspective that Iran is a threat to Israel?
Well, first, I would just step back and say that in responding to Michael's comments, that I think that there actually was a fair amount of coverage in the domestic media about the breach of protocol, as it was termed, of Boehner unilaterally inviting Netanyahu to come and speak. I do think that after the speech was given, the media attention, I believe totally understandably, shifted to the content of the speech and what policy implications that might have. So I think there was a tension over the past couple of weeks, and it ended around the time the speech occurred. In terms of how the speech has been framed and how it should be understood, I do think that the media, for the most part, has been covering the track record of Netanyahu in coming to Congress and saying these things. In the 1990s, in 1995, he wrote that Iran would have a nuclear weapon in 3 to 5 years. In 1996, speaking before the joint session of Congress, he warned that the deadline for Iran acquiring a nuclear weapon was getting extremely close. In the 2000s, he shifted that focus to Iraq, testifying before Congress that Iraq was operating centrifuges the size of washing machines. And all of that has gotten probably far more attention than it ever did in the past, which does show at least critical coverage from the media in framing what was said. I think if there's one takeaway that maybe hasn't been discussed enough, although it has certainly gotten some attention, it's that Netanyahu, we'll assume that everything he said he believed, and that he does hold these legitimate concerns about Iran posing a security threat to Israel. Given what a huge threat he believes Iran and this agreement poses, he offered very little in terms of a concrete alternative. He essentially said that he thought the deal coming together was a bad deal, which of course he's entitled to. But it's interesting that there was no "so then what." He said, "If you should go back and negotiate a better deal," And it begs the question, well, so what were the outlines of a better deal? What were the outlines of an acceptable deal look like to the prime minister? And that's a question that really, I think, a lot of people were left asking when it was over.
And Chris, what would you add to that?
I do think there's a big question over what Netanyahu achieved, and I suppose you have to look at what you think he came to do. Clearly, the election element of it was important. I think, you know, he's the leader of Likud. Likud is a party that does well when it scares the voters, and there are big social issues in Israel at the moment, and Netanyahu wants to keep people focused on Iran, on being scared, on Hamas, rather than the social issues. And in that sense, he may have achieved something, may not. We'll know in a couple of weeks. In terms of affecting the outcome of these negotiations, I think it's, in some ways, it's been a disaster for him, because his speech was pretty empty. The very fact that he said in his speech that all of this information was readily available on Google goes to show just how little that he had to offer that was new. And as Eli says, I think it was a huge gaping hole that he offered no alternative solutions. There was nothing there. I think what he did achieve in the end was the unprecedented in recent times end of managing to split Democrats from absolutely solid support for Israel, no matter what. And they have now got to a point, at least some of them in Congress, where they distinguish between support for Israel and support for the actions of Israeli governments. And I would have thought that as the Prime Minister of Israel, he should be very uncomfortable with that outcome.
Chris McGrill is a senior writer with The Guardian. Eli Clifton is a reporting fellow with the Investigative Fund at The Nation. And Golnar Motivali is a correspondent for Bloomberg News based in Tehran. Golnar, what other stories? You briefly touched on how sanctions are negatively affecting Iranians. What other stories do we need to know about? Because we tend not to get, you know, many stories about Iran from various capitals in the United States. What is your focus?
I mean, I focus on the economy and the political situation and politics. For me, other than sanctions, there are a few domestic issues going on in Iran, which I think are very interesting that people may not know about. There is a huge push by Rouhani's government right now to really crack down on corruption. And this is corruption that dates back really to the previous government of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. And there is a sanctions angle to this issue as well, because the system that developed after sanctions were enforced of transferring money and dollars into the country and selling oil and selling gas. We know that there's a huge corruption scandal in Turkey at the moment that's being investigated, involving the sale of Iranian gas to Turkey in exchange for gold. I mean, the outcome of a lot of these sanctions was the kind of the growth of very opaque systems of trade and transaction that were in the hands of a very few numbers of dealers who ended up reaping huge amounts of profits from these trades. And these corruption cases are still ongoing. And because the amounts are so big, they actually end up filtering through into different institutions as well.
And Golnar, hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break. Today, it's our media roundtable, and we are discussing media coverage of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's 40-minute address to Congress on Tuesday. We'll be back after this.
The weekly media roundtable on your call here. 91.7 FM KALW San Francisco is a program that relies on engaged listeners. We invite you to join today's conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Or you can post your question or comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock, Inflection Point, a new program on the schedule for Fridays here on Local Public Radio. And following that, at noon, it's the Tavis Smiley Show.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we'll have a conversation with Robert Kenner, director of the new documentary Merchants of Doubt. It examines the history of corporate-financed efforts to convince the public to doubt scientific findings. How have think tanks spread doubt about crucial health issues like tobacco, flame retardants in furniture, and climate change? That's on Monday. Tuesday, we'll be having a conversation about the Right to Die movement. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about media coverage of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's 40-minute address to Congress on Tuesday. It was boycotted by almost 60 Democrats, received 23 standing ovations, and widespread coverage in the media. So what really struck you about the angles journalists took, the people they went to for comments and quotes? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. Today we're joined by Eli Clifton, reporting fellow with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute, Chris McGreal, senior writer for The Guardian U.S., and Golnar Motivali, a correspondent for Bloomberg News based in Tehran. And let's go next to Max in Berkeley. Hi, Max. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for taking my call, and thank you for the very good program, as usual. I read something interesting in the French newspaper Libération about who owns nuclear weapons in the world, in the nine countries, without giving you a list of them. Of course, Israel is very prominent on that list with 80 warheads and material to produce 200 more warheads. And, of course, today we have an arms race, a nuclear arms race. But it's interesting to note that it started years ago with Israel, with the assistance of the French and indirectly the American government. They got the assistance, technical assistance, the material to some extent to produce nuclear weapons. They started the arms race in that part of the world. And that is a huge responsibility. I understand the fears today, fueled in part by the irresponsible comments of former President Ahmadinejad. I understand that. Very real fears. But Israel has not played a very prominent role in all of this. In addition, I'd like to mention the role that Israel played in Africa, in South Africa, when it helped the South African government before Mandela to produce nuclear weapons that were dismantled, when apartheid was dismantled. I'd like to hear the comments from you guys if these things were discussed at all.
Okay, thank you. So Chris McGreal, in January, your colleague at The Guardian, Julian Borger, wrote a long piece about Israel's nuclear program. According to his piece, like Max said, Israel has 80 nuclear warheads, and the same blueprints and players were involved in helping Pakistan set up a smuggling business designed to help Libya, North Korea, and Iran. And he writes, for that reason, Israel's centrifuges are nearly identical to Iran's, a convergence that allowed Israel to try out a computer worm codenamed Stuxnet. So what are your thoughts on this? And what about Max's question? Why doesn't Israel's nuclear program get the same scrutiny as Iran's? And do you think it should in the media?
Well, it's a question that's long been asked. I mean, why doesn't it get the same scrutiny? I think partly because it's been there for so long and it's accepted that it's there. There's been books written about how it came about. And, I mean, Israel has helped other countries, most notably apartheid South Africa, to develop nuclear weapons. Should it be held to up to public scrutiny? Well, it's going to take a country like the United States to actually do something about that, and that's not really going to happen. Should it be written about? Absolutely. My view on Israel and its nuclear weapons and all of this is there is a double standard. Israel, when I was based in Israel 10 years ago, they began to acknowledge this by talking about responsible countries and irresponsible countries. And Israel regards itself as a responsible country with nuclear weapons. And others, Pakistan, for instance, it's that on Kent on Iran, obviously not. But there's undoubtedly a double standard, and undoubtedly Israel has played a part in nuclear proliferation. There's no doubt about it.
Golnar, what are your thoughts on this? We just got an email from Henry, who also asks this question. He says, in the scores of stories I heard and read about the speech, including dozens on NPR, I never noted any mention of Israel's nuclear weapons. Does this get much coverage in Iran?
Well, actually, on Wednesday evening, or by Wednesday evening, some of the most senior voices in Iranian politics were bringing up this point. The Speaker of Parliament was one of the first officials to refer to the fact that Israel reportedly has nuclear warheads, and President Rouhani himself, he gave quite a strong response on Wednesday night, ridiculing the speech, calling Israel an illegitimate regime, and asking how it could possibly make these comments given its own stock, what he referred to as a stockpile of nuclear weapons. So, yeah, I think widely it's written about in Iran. State media, in particular, write about this, and it's often used as a kind of a sign of the hypocrisy of Israel's position on this issue.
Well, I know we have to let you go, so thank you for joining us, Golnar.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. That is Golnar Motivali. She's a correspondent for Bloomberg News based in Tehran. And joining us for the rest of the hour is Chris McGreal, senior writer with The Guardian U.S., a former Washington correspondent. He was posted in Jerusalem 10 years ago. And Eli Clifton is a reporting fellow with the Investigative Fund at The Nation. He writes about money and politics and U.S. foreign policy. And today we're talking about media coverage of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's address to Congress. It was boycotted by 60 Democrats, received 23 standing ovations, and received widespread coverage in the media for the last 2 weeks. So what stood out for you? What are your thoughts about the angles journalists took? What was missing? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear next from David in Berkeley. Hi, David.
Hi, good morning. I appreciate the caller's earlier question about accountability of nuclear offenses that Netanyahu and his government are hiding. It's remindful of the hide-and-seek Cold War era before the SALT Treaty years. And, the Kerry and EU negotiations are a good faith contract. And I think Netanyahu's argument is false when he says deals, because the negotiation is good faith contracts, different than a contract of goods. And it's apparent that he comes here trying to keep supporting the warmongering and the trade of the $12 billion annual waging of war that we sell by armaments and nuclear arms.
Well, thank you for that. Eli, what are your thoughts on reporting on negotiations? Because they're very secretive. You had Iran's foreign minister say that we want to have an agreement, we want to work around the clock. John Kerry said there are still significant gaps and important choices that need to be made. So how do journalists find out what's actually happening in these negotiations? Because the information is disseminated through the official state channels. Eli? Did we lose Eli? Chris, do you want to take that one?
Sure. I mean, it's like the nature of reporting these things is extremely difficult. You're not in the room. You're reliant on other people's interpretation of what happened. They obviously have a spin to put on it. The more people that you can talk to who are in the room, the better. But with these negotiations, both sides have been pretty good at keeping the information sealed, keeping a limited stream of information coming out. And it's, it's in part because the reality is you can only make progress on negotiations if every single piece of proposal that's put on the table isn't made public and have proper discussions. I get that. But it is very difficult to judge exactly where these talks are at, and who's prepared to give what. And what was partly demonstrated by Netanyahu, now he apparently is no longer being fully briefed on what's going on in the room, because the United States no longer trusts him not to misuse the information and leak it into the Israeli press. It seems the Israelis themselves are actually pretty uncertain of just how far these talks have got.
Eli, are you back with us?
I am.
Okay, sorry about that. What are your thoughts on that, just about the reporting that we get about the negotiations that go on behind the scenes? Because the only way that we get information is through official state channels.
I believe that the amount of information we're getting has decreased dramatically. I think the fear of leaks, the reality of leaks, has played a large role over the past year in the negotiations. We've seen a lot more news stories coming out based off of anonymous sources, based off of experts experts in the negotiations who shouldn't have been discussing with journalists. And kudos to the journalists who got those stories. But I think that a combination of fears about Israel misusing information and leaks to try to end the negotiations prematurely. As well as just generally the fact that I believe that if there is to be a deal, we are probably coming into the last few weeks of negotiations. There's a likelihood of that. Certainly, the Iranians have expressed that view. And if that is the case, I can understand that we will be hearing less and less out of non-official channels.
Eli Clifton is reporting fellow with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute, and Chris McGreal is senior writer with The Guardian U.S. Today we're talking about media coverage of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's address to Congress. What really struck you about media coverage of this, the angles that were taken, the people that were actually chosen to talk about this, especially some of the politicians? What struck you about that? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Eli, you've been writing a lot of stories about money and following the money on this particular issue. You've got two pieces in the Nation. One, how the anti-Iran lobby machine dominates Capitol Hill. The other one, GOP mega donor Sheldon Adelson funds mysterious anti-Iran pressure group. What did you find in your reporting about the money that's funding this?
I think the thing that surprises me about it time and time again is how a relatively small number of individuals who do have deep pockets but are certainly not the only people in the political game with deep pockets have been able to influence to perhaps a disproportionate degree the debate on Capitol Hill. And I think a lot of that has been done through 501c3 think tanks, nonprofits, where funding them is not necessarily made publicly available through disclosures, and it requires a fair amount of sleuthing to try to figure out who are the major donors supporting these groups. And when you start to figure it out, you realize that it's a relatively small number of folks, people like Paul Singer, people like Sheldon Adelson. And I think if there was an aspect of the speech that that maybe didn't get its fair shake in media reports, it was the role that money and politics played, because Sheldon Adelson was there in the gallery. He's the number one donor to the Republican Party in the last presidential election cycle. He's also one of Netanyahu's biggest campaign contributors and a close personal friend of both Netanyahu and his wife. And I think that Adelson clearly played a role, either directly or indirectly, in making this speech happen, in encouraging Netanyahu to do it, in encouraging Boehner to issue the invitation. And I think that is something that probably deserved a little more attention.
You report that one-third of anti-Iran pressure groups united against nuclear Iran's 2013 budget came from Sheldon Adelson. He invested a reported $98 million to defeat Obama in 2012. It did get a little coverage over at Moyers.com. Bill Moyers wrote a piece, Netanyahu Speaks, Money Talks. He also wrote that Adelson contributed $150 million to Republicans, including $93 million to Karl Rove's American Crossroads and the Republican Jewish Coalition Victory Fund. Did you have anything to add on this, Chris? Does this get much attention in the European press?
No, I mean, I think what did get attention were the links between Netanyahu and Likud and his aides, Netanyahu's aides, and Ron Dermer, the Israeli ambassador to Washington and the Republican Party, and the overlap between Derma, who is an American-born Republican activist till he became Israeli, and then the ambassador to Washington. That overlap did get written about, and that the what essentially looked very much like a conspiracy between Derma and Boehner's office to hook up this with, as Eli says, plenty of money behind it. There was definitely a web of interests there, an overlap, and that got attention, perhaps less so the money.
Chris McGreal is a senior writer with The Guardian U.S., and Eli Clifton is a reporting fellow with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute. And let's go to our next caller, John, in San Francisco. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning. My sympathies lie with the negotiations. I regard Mr. Netanyahu as Mr. Bluster. He just doesn't have much credibility with me. However, we have to remember that we had negotiations years ago with North Korea in which we thought we had an agreement that would prevent them from getting nuclear weapons. That didn't work out very well. North Korea has nuclear weapons. And so I think Israel has good reason to be suspicious of our negotiations being successful. Not that we don't have good faith in stopping Iran from getting nuclear weapons, but that we might blunder like we did with North Korea. We can't afford to blunder because Iran, unlike Israel, threatens other nations with terrorism. And so I'd like to get your guests' comments on this, please.
Chris, do you want to take that one?
Well, one would suppose that lessons from North Korea have been learned, particularly because, as your caller says, there's more at stake in some ways with Iran, and that any agreement would not permit the Iranians to do what the North Koreans were able to do, which is simply walk away and carry on. I could only assume that that's in there and going to be a pretty rock-solid part of the agreement. If not, then I would imagine that whatever deal is done will, come under incredible assault from both Israel and the Republicans here.
What are your thoughts, Eli?
I think that the comparison to North Korea does come up quite frequently, but I think it's also important to take a closer look at it and say, well, it's true. We don't want to have happen what happened with North Korea. But the common claim that, Iran wants what North Korea got should also be looked at with a bit of skepticism. North Korea has not been able to run roughshod across Greater East Asia. They have not advanced their position against South Korea, against the United States. They are still, in many ways, one of the world's most isolated pariah states. They are still dependent on China for most forms of fuel aid, food, and trade for the limited products that they export. It hasn't dramatically improved their situation in the region, which is, once again, important to emphasize. We don't want that to happen with Iran, but this is not a good case study of an example of how getting a nuclear weapon can dramatically improve one's standing in a region.
Well, and also, what about the other angle here about U.S. aid? And you pointed this out in your column, Chris, that Netanyahu thanked President Obama and Congress for funding the Iron Dome anti-missile shield. And the Harvard Shorenstein Center on Media Politics and Public Policy put out a paper called U.S. Foreign Aid to Israel 2014 Congressional Report, including information about, in addition to the $3 billion in funding yearly, the Obama administration requested $96 million for joint U.S.-Israeli programs, $175 million for the Iron Dome and other rockets. And what are your thoughts on that? I mean, do you think that this issue also deserves more attention?
Yes, again, I think it gets quite a lot of attention. I think it's pretty clear to anybody that reads regularly about Israel, the level and strength of American support. And I think, fundamentally that isn't going to change. In military terms, in intelligence terms, The Obama administration has been as strong and in some ways stronger in its support of Israel than previous administrations. There is a separation both between individuals, Netanyahu and Obama, that clearly they don't get along. Clearly, it's been rare for an Israeli prime minister to treat a U.S. president with such contempt. So there's a personal animosity there. There's also a deep policy differences. But that doesn't spill over into American support on security, and it's unlikely to for a very long time unless there's a fundamentally different kind of breach. I do think it gets coverage. I do think most people are aware of the level of support, and they're aware of, of how the United States protects Israel in international forums, United Nations and many other lesser forums. I think that the diplomatic cover that the United States gives over, for instance, last year's war in Gaza is you know, pretty well covered. I don't think people have any illusions about that.
Chris McGreal is a senior writer with The Guardian U.S. Eli Clifton is a reporting fellow with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute. We have an email from Martha, who says, ultimately, I see the speech as a cynical ploy made for political reasons by the Republicans and Netanyahu facing a strong election challenge next week. We have another listener who says, I want to agree with your earlier caller that while Netanyahu's tactics were disgraceful enough, the real shame is on the American members of Congress who invited him in the first place. I think the media focus should be there. Again, I wanted to read a tweet that Matt Taibbi in Rolling Stone pointed out. Yigal Kaspi, Israel's ambassador to Switzerland, retweeted a line from an Israeli journalist saying it's no longer possible to suffice in scaring us here in Hebrew. Netanyahu has to fly all the way to the U.S. Congress and tell them in English how dangerous Iran's nuclear program is. And Kaspi and two other diplomats got fired for that tweet. Chris, you know, now that there's time to actually analyze, you don't have to be obsessed with putting your story out immediately after the speech. Now that you've had time to sort of step back and think about this, why do you think he gave this speech? Why did he come to the U.S. to do this?
Well, I think, as I said earlier, I think it was aimed at doing a number of things. I think as an electoral ploy, it was a primary factor for him. It happened to coincide. I'm not sure whether he planned it this well, but it happened to coincide with the end of the electoral campaign permitting those kind of broadcasts in Israel. So he basically got a free run on national television in Israel, and that was definitely a factor. As I say, you know, Likud is not a party that campaigns on hope; it campaigns on fear. And undoubtedly, that speech was aimed at whipping up fear in making it more of an electoral, more central to the election in Israel. I think in terms of what it was supposed to achieve in the United States, I think it's absolutely true that the Republicans and Netanyahu sought together to embarrass Obama, both in general terms, but also specifically over the negotiations in Iran. I mean, if it was meant as a speech that was going to change the mind of anybody in the United States, I think it probably fell down for the reasons we've already talked about, that there was nothing really new in there, and it certainly didn't offer any solutions. If it was intended to change or persuade members of Congress to vote in favor of a bill that would strengthen sanctions against Iran, which is on the table at the moment, I can't imagine that it was particularly effective in doing that, given that it managed to actually split Congress and lead to this astonishing walkout, which we haven't seen before, by nearly 60 Democrats in both houses. So I think it backfired quite badly in all of that. But I think in the end, for Netanyahu, the primary thing, it was an election campaign stunt.
Eli, what are your thoughts on the coverage of the Democrats, the 60 Dems who walked out? And the Nancy Pelosi statement got a lot of attention. She put out a statement. She did go to the speech, but she put out a statement saying, quote, the state of Israel stands as the greatest political achievement of the 20th century, and the U.S. will always have an unshakable commitment to Israel's security. That is why, as one who values the U.S.-Israel relationship and loves Israel, I was near tears throughout the speech, saddened by the insult to the entire intelligence of the U.S. and saddened by the condescension toward our knowledge of the threat posed by Iran. What are your thoughts on the coverage of what this means for the Democrats?
Well, a couple of congressional staffers I've spoken with both thought that Pelosi's decision to attend the speech was very defendable, given the fact that because she was there, she was able to issue this statement, and that maybe if other Democrats had chosen to attend, they too could have so harshly denounced it. But yeah, I think that the takeaway, which is being largely interpreted by the media that I've been seeing, is that Netanyahu, for his perhaps own cynical reasons, but certainly it's consistent, as was just said, with Likud's agenda, with their policies, and when Netanyahu, as a politician in Israel for the past 30 years, has been expressing these fears toward Iran, and that is really the bedrock of his political identity. So it shouldn't take us by that much of a surprise. What is surprising is that there has been this split, apparently along partisan lines, in Congress regarding supporting Netanyahu and what is being characterized by supporters of the speech as holding a pro-Israel position. The fact that that's occurring at seemingly no political cost to those Democrats, if anything, occurring with a political benefit to them, is brand new. We're in uncharted territory here. The fact that that Netanyahu has managed to accomplish that may be really the lasting impact of this speech.
We also didn't have time to mention this, but you wrote about this. Sheldon Adelson is spending a lot of money through his newspapers in Israel to help get Netanyahu elected. But we will follow that election and cover it. You can find Eli Clifton's reporting at yourcallradio.org. He's a fellow with the Investigative Fund at The Nation. You can also find Chris McGreal's articles. He's a senior writer for The Guardian U.S. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. How have think tanks spread doubt about crucial public health issues like tobacco, flame retardants in furniture, and climate change? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with Robert Kenner, director of Merchants of Doubt, a documentary that examines the history of corporate-financed efforts to convince the public to doubt scientific findings. How can citizens influence climate change policy when the media give the doubters so much attention? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Nock Nguyen produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. And Matt Martin is executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.